It's Tuesday, August 1st, 2006. This is Ellen Nori Nordhauser. I'm recording Professor Sheila Ruth, retired from the Department of Philosophy, for the history of SIUE. How you happened to come to the university? See the little light?
Okay.
Winking.
Okay. Okay. You want the unexpurgated truth?
Yes, of course.
Well, I was teaching at the University of Evansville, Indiana. I was married at the time. And my husband and I had a very public and unpleasant divorce. Mm-hmm. And one of us had to go.
Uh-huh.
And as you might expect, it was the woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so I lost my job.
Okay.
And that was my very first position.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some acrimony between me and my chair, head of my department, who wanted to counsel me since I was a poor, disturbed ex-wife, and I didn't want to be counseled.
Mm-hmm.
So I lost my job. I got fired.
Gosh.
And they gave me, according to AAUP rules, 1 year to go find another job.
Did you have a tenure track contract?
I did.
Uh-huh.
But I was not yet tenured. This was
uh-huh.
like in my first or second year there.
Uh-huh.
And so I appealed to the AAUP, but they said since I wasn't tenured, it didn't matter to the university. It didn't matter to them why the university let me go. That they don't have to state reasons.
Oh.
And so I had no recourse.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent a year trying to find another position, but without a letter of recommendation. That was not easy.
Gee.
And I was on my last month's salary. It was in May of the second year. And I was totally out of money and out of luck and out of a job. And I went to the APA convention in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was at the very last evening they have a smoker. I don't know if the AHA has the same.
They used to have a smoker. They probably don't have it anymore.
They probably don't call it that anymore. But they had a smoker on the last night where desperate faculty looking for jobs can throw themselves in the way of professors that they think are giving out jobs. And that's what I was doing. I was wandering around this thing. And the truth is, the unvarnished truth is, somebody pinched my butt. And I turned around and said to him, if you're going to pinch my butt, you better have a job to give away. And he said, are you really looking for one? And
uh-huh.
I said, yes, I am. And he said, well, come with me. And it turned out to be the philosophy department at SIU. And they were, you know, there were lots of them there that night, probably 10 or so. And they said, well, you're pretty brave to have quit your job before finding another, said they delicately. And I said, not so brave, I got fired.
Yeah.
Clean. And they said, oh, that's wonderful. Three or four of us have been fired from our last jobs, too. And we hit it off, and I got a one-year appointment to
mm-hmm.
cover a position for another faculty member who was teaching at Northern that year.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got a second year because he decided to stay. And then there's another long story how they decided to make my appointment continuing.
Mm-hmm.
But they did. And so I came, I came in 71.
You did, okay.
Mm-hmm. And my appointment became continuing in 73.
Hmm.
Goodness.
So for the better part of my adult life, I have lived here attached to the SIU. Mm-hmm. So that is how I came to be not in Kansas anymore.
Okay. Well, since you came here so early, the philosophy department was it still in formation, or Carol Keene had arrived in 68?
Oh, yeah, she came, she was here well before me.
And Charles Core was from
Core
here.
Core was here, in fact, Core
and Jerry
was
Runkle.
Chair. Runkle was dean, and Core was chair
okay.
when I came here. And
Bill Linden.
Linden was here. Actually, most of them were here.
Uh-huh.
And they had formed a real community by the time I came here. They were all about the same age, you know, young people. They liked each other.
Mm-hmm.
You could feel that.
Mm-hmm.
It was a community, I would say, more than any other department I've ever been around.
Mm-hmm.
Philosophy was a community. And they had already started writing working papers, which were not yet required at the time. But they thought it was a good idea, so they already had working papers. I'm trying to remember whether there was, I think I was the second woman in the department. I think Carol was the only woman in the department at that time. There had been another woman in the department, but I don't think she got tenured. And I never met her. So there I was. And my specialty at the time was social and political philosophy and philosophy of science. Philosophy of social science.
Mm-hmm.
And that I was hired to teach those two things specifically.
Mm-hmm. And did you have any interest in women's studies at that time?
It didn't exist.
Uh-huh.
It didn't exist in 71. And if it did, I didn't know about it. I was an ardent feminist.
Mm-hmm.
And I had been involved in the women's movement in both in Buffalo, where I went to graduate school, and in Evansville. And I had done lots of speeches and some television work. You know, people would interview me for, you know, what does all this mean and stuff. And I was not a member of SDS in Buffalo, but hung around in that group and was, you know, an activist at the time, an anti-war activist. And if you were anti-war, then all of the other social movements, which were very powerful at the time, you were up against, you were with all of them.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew feminist activists, and I guess I was a feminist, you know, right after I was born. This was even when I was a kid.
Was your mother, did your mother work?
My mother did work.
Uh-huh.
But she was a very traditional woman. She was a typist. And my father was a construction worker. And my mother worked because we needed the money. But as far as their belief system, they were very conventional, very traditional. My grandfather was a rabbi, Orthodox. And so the role of men and women, boys and girls, was very,
very
different. Oh, yeah. My brother, he went to Hebrew school, and my grandfather taught him how mm-hmm. to pray in Hebrew and so on. And I got to spend my time in the kitchen with my grandmother learning how to kosher chickens.
Okay.
And keep a kosher home so that my husband could talk directly to God
uh-huh.
and not be fussing around with household things.
Hmm.
So that was my upbringing, and that was my beginning. And I strenuously resented the differences in mm-hmm. privilege between my brother and me.
Uh-huh.
And I used to ask things like, how come Michael gets to go and do this and that, and my brother, and I have to stay home with you and do laundry? And my mother would say, because you're the girl. And when I was very little, I didn't think to say yes or.
Uh-huh.
But by the time I got to be fifth grade, sixth grade,
mm-hmm.
then I started to say, what's that got to do?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer was, don't be a smartass. I didn't get any answers. And I was the smart one in school. I loved school.
Mm-hmm.
And I did very well in school. And my brother could barely get from one grade to another. He was very bright, but he hated school.
Uh-huh.
And my mother used to say, someday my dreams for my children are that Michael will go to college and have a wonderful career, and Sheila will meet a wonderful man and get married and have wonderful children. And I would say, but I want to go to college uh-huh. and have a wonderful career. And I would always get, oh, what am I going to do with that?
Oh, dear.
So, that may, I didn't have language for it at the time. There,
mm-hmm.
nobody talked about feminism. I mm-hmm. never heard that word. And there was no word yet in use called sexism.
Mm-hmm.
That union movement came into being in the mid-60s, early 70s.
Yeah.
There was no, I had no way to capture
mm-hmm.
the insights that I was having. Some, this is not fair, I used to think, but I couldn't go much beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't capture the feelings. I just thought it was all very unfair.
Did you have any friends at this point, or any,
oh God, yeah.
any aunts or anybody who was a little irregular? Or, you always wonder how people's heads get cracked. I mean, obviously an intelligent person.
I have no idea where it came from. No, I all of my family, you know, we lived in a typical New York City extended family system.
Uh-huh.
I grew up in a Jewish neighborhood, Orthodox Jewish neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole
community
was based around the synagogue,
mm-hmm.
which of course you can imagine was pretty conventional. And my mother's family, there were five brothers and sisters, all very conventional, all lived right, you know, had apartments mm-hmm. right next door. And I lived with my, right next door, my mother and father's apartment was mm-hmm. my grandmother's apartment,
mm-hmm.
who was extremely religious, was born in Austria.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather, too. You know, it's funny, I'm related almost always to my grandmother. That ever my grandfather was very distant
mm-hmm.
creature. My grandmother was, I spent more time with her than I was my mother. And she was very religious.
Mm-hmm.
And very conventional in many ways.
But I was her favorite, because there were four of us. I had two cousins, and my brother and myself all lived around my grandma. And they did not like talking about religion or Europe. And I loved it. So we would kosher chickens, and she would tell me about the little stable where she had grown up. And I decided I wanted to be a rabbi. Oh, that's too funny for words. Ha ha ha, Sheila wants to be a rabbi. Could be a, my grandmother, she could be a rabbi's wife. Could be a rabbit. That would be a great honor. And I said, I'm going to be a rabbit tonight. She'd say, now, don't be difficult. Not as you can.
It, foolish child. That's not the way it works.
So I would snarl and think that's not fair. I guess that's where it came from. No one that I can remember but that's an interesting question. I had a not she wasn't an aunt, but she sort of functioned as an aunt. By marriage several degrees off, there was a woman who encouraged me to go to college. So I knew it was a possibility, something that could happen. But we had no money. And I didn't know how it was going to happen, but I thought, that's what I want to do. So, when I was seventh grade, my parents moved out of the city to a little village, I guess you could call it, north of the city, about 50 miles north of New York, and it might as well have been along the Ganges, out in the middle of nowhere. We were the only Jewish family for many miles around. And that didn't make me popular. It was such a change of head. I mean, from being, you know, the Rebbe's Zeno, the rabbi's granddaughter. Big fuss, major deal, to this little community, and we went to a school. They had a central school from kindergarten through 12 for all the little towns around there. And all these kids had been together since kindergarten. They were already buddies, and I came in the seventh grade. I didn't look like anybody. I didn't talk like anybody. I was Jewish, and, you know, proud of it at the time. And it was tough. I had a tough high school life. But I was pretty smart. That was a problem for them, and it was a problem for me. I was either first or second in my class. And I said I wanted to go to college. And I don't remember, I think, I'm trying to remember, there was one teacher, I don't remember her name, but she said, if you want to go to college, you work very hard, you could do it. I help you. I think her name was Mrs. Frith. F-R-I-T-H. She was my Latin teacher. And I liked her. And I think they arranged for me. I'd never heard of it before, but they said, New York City has a school that's free. can go without any money at all.
Uh-huh.
So they applied for me, as I recall. I didn't even know how to do it.
City University?
Well, it is now City University. In those days, City University didn't exist. There were five free colleges, one in each borough. And Hunter had two schools, one in Manhattan and one in the Bronx. And the school in the Bronx was within walking distance of one of my aunt's apartments. And so I applied there. And then I talked my parents into moving back to the Bronx. And we did. And my mother thought, well, my father didn't want me to go. He kept saying, what are you going to do with a diploma? Hang it over a sink? My father had been a farmer in his youth.
Yes.
And, you know, women don't go to college. And he was very worried when I decided I wanted to go to college. This is a pretty dumb thing to do, you know. And my mother, though, who had been a typist often, thought that nothing would be more wonderful than for me to get a year of college, because then I could be a private secretary.
Okay.
I mean, this was her dream, right? That's what she had always looked up to, you know, from her perspective, the private secretaries, wow, that was, they got better salary, they had an office, they wore suits. That was something. So if I could get in a year of college, I could be a private secretary. So she talked my father into letting me go. And the rest is
history.
Yeah. Every year she'd say, so now you're going to quit. I'm going to do another year. But I loved school. I loved college.
I think Belinda Carstens would come right to Potter.
Did she? The Manhattan one?
Yeah, I think so.
That was the one in Manhattan was huge, and it was like a six-story building. It was a high-rise.
I think she did.
The Bronx one had a campus, which I thought was just too wonderful to work. But then the Bronx campus broke off. It became Lehman College. It's, I believe it is now Lehman College, but the old Bronx Hunter. And I don't remember what year it was, but sometime right after I graduated, City University came into existence, and then all the colleges became part of the City University of the City of New York, CUNY, City University of New York. And that's where I graduated. And then I went to Buffalo, which was part of the SUNY system. I got married, and we went off together. He was in psychology, I was in philosophy. And I went into philosophy because it was the only fellowship open. I had a political science undergraduate degree.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I was not a philosopher. But they took me, and it was free. So off I went.
Well, they had a pretty good philosophy department, too.
Huge. They had, like, at the time, 60 people in the philosophy department. So it was just gigantic.
Were there any women?
In my department, none. And that is really kind of, now that's when my feminist life really, there was no feminism, but graduate students were, the university was in a suburb of Buffalo. I don't remember the name of it. But it was an old school, over 100 years mm-hmm. old. It had been Buffalo College. And graduate students were given private houses along the outer edge of the university where, you know, the graduate assistants had offices.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like a 20-minute walk from the philosophy graduate office to the main campus.
Uh-huh.
And you know, Buffalo, it snows all the time.
Yes.
So it was always cold and snowy. And I was the only woman in the graduate group at the time.
Gosh.
So the first issue was, where the hell are they going to put me? Where am I going to go to the bathroom? That was a major issue. And will I put flowers in the kitchen? They were worried about that, the upgrades.
In the house?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, because, see, the kitchen belonged to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one bathroom. And it was one of those, it was an old house, and the toilet was under the window. So the distance between the toilet and the door into the bathroom was easily from that door to here.
Mm-hmm.
And it had no lock on the door. So
uh-huh.
clearly, the one girl in the department could not use that bathroom as far as they were concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Who, you know, somebody might walk in on her, this would be the end of the world. So I used to have to trudge up this 20-minute walk through the snow every time I had to go to the bathroom.
Oh, dear.
And, you know, I was so happy to be there, I wasn't going to argue.
Uh-huh.
But after about 6 months of trudging, I said, couldn't I please use the bathroom? And I would hang a sign, and so then there was this, all the grad students got together and they had this big meeting about where Sheila could go to the bathroom. I swear to God, this happened. And finally, they all agreed that as if I didn't mind the possibility that they might walk in on me, I could go to the bathroom. I was so happy not to have to trudge through the snow every time I had to take a whiz. Fine. I mean, I grew up with a brother and cousin.
Yes.
As I can. So and sure, I don't mind. And it became a joke. And so then they accepted me very comfortably. But I do remember that. And then the second thing that really opened my head, every year they had a contest going back to the early days of the school where all the undergraduates would elect their favorite faculty person, and they would name him Mr. Faculty.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the year, he would be presented at the student doodah and given a prize. So one of the dormitories nominated me. And the big question was, what were they going to call me? I wasn't Mr. Faculty. That wouldn't do. Well, how about Miss Faculty? And I said, no, that has the wrong implications altogether. Well, could you be Mrs. Faculty? And I said, no, it couldn't be that either. Well, then what are we going to call you? And I said, well, I guess I'll just have to be Mr. Faculty. There was no alternative.
Uh-huh.
And I remember that opening my mind in a big way.
Mm-hmm.
And I did get elected. and in fact, here is my Mr. Faculty.
Oh no.
Oh yes.
Among all the other Mr. Faculty.
Far out, huh?
Yes.
And I thought, you know, I mean, it was part of my awakening. It's like,
uh-huh.
Geez, there should be something to call me.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't. And that was before Ms.
Uh-huh.
was introduced. That was long before Ms. So when the women's movement started to really articulate some of these ideas, man, I was into it up to my hairline. And I kept thinking, my God, that, you know, I mean, my God, that's right. My God, that's right. And the man that I was married to was very interesting. In the beginning, he very much supported my views that my career was as important as his, that my ideas were no less meaningful than his. And in 67, it was unusual.
Yes, it was.
And that was after some of the literature started to come out. The feminine mystique I had read as an undergraduate. And I had tried to get into the law program at Hunter, and they wouldn't let me. That was right about when I was reading feminism. They said, no, no. I had gone to the law, you know, the director of the law program, and said, I want to go into the pre-law program. And he said, why? And I said, because I want to go to law school. And I did. And he said, no, no, you don't want to do that. And I said, yes, yes, I'll do it. And he said, Miss Suck, you will never finish the pre-law program. And if you do, it won't help because you will never get into law school. And even if you got into law school, you would never get a job. And even if you got a job, you couldn't stay because you're going to get married and have children, and that would be a big waste. So go do something else. So when I read Betty Friedan, you know, all these things came together.
Yes, came together.
Just, you know, it was just, it was like I was learning more from these life experiences than ever I read in a book. And in philosophy, you can only imagine what they thought about women.
So, oh, I have an intimation of what they thought about them here. I always
I bet you do. Oh dear, yes, well, that's another thing altogether. So when I came here, I had like two intellectual lives, separate and apart. One of them was philosophy, which I loved. And one of them was feminist literature. But I never ever had thought to put the two together. They had nothing in common. There was no such thing as women's studies that I knew. And I think in my second year here, in my first year here, I gave a paper in Texas and began to doubt that I belonged in philosophy. This is after the PhD. I wrote a paper about that. It's floating around somewhere. Runkle was dean at the time, and he called me in and said, Sheila, I understand you're interested in feminism. I don't remember. Women's liberation is what they didn't call it feminism. They called it women's liberation. God, memories. And he said, I understand you're interested in women's liberation. And I said, yes, I am. And he said, what do you know about women's studies? And I said, what's that? And he said, well, this woman from St. Louis is apparently doing some research about women's studies, about, but yeah, academic, women's liberation in academia mm-hmm. or something. And he said, she'd like to interview someone here, and you are the only person I know who's interested in women's liberation.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I don't know anything at all about women's studies. I never heard of it. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, would you mind if she interviewed you? I said, no, I can't tell her much, but I can't remember her name right now, but I will. So she came, we had coffee or lunch or something, and she was telling me about this academic area where people were looking at women's lives. I said, geez, where is that? And she said, you know, I don't know anything about it, but I understand that Gloria Steinem is going to be in town next week, and mm-hmm. she's speaking at such and such a place. Why don't you go and talk to her? And I had her Gloria Steinem. So I said, okay, I'll do it. And I did. And I don't remember how, she wrangled me the ticket to go and hear her. And I don't know how she did that. But afterwards, it was all very relaxed and informal. And I remember Steinem was sitting
on the edge of
the stage, and people were going up and asking her questions. And I introduced myself, and I said, I understand there's a thing called women's academic feminism or something. And she said, well, there are a couple of faculty people out east who are kicking it around. And I said, I would like to know about this. And she gave me the name of Sheila Tobias,
mm-hmm.
who was at that time the provost at Wesleyan.
Mm-hmm.
And she gave me a phone number. And she said, call this woman up and tell her you have an interest and see what she said. I was too dumb at the time to be scared. I didn't know any of this stuff. So I went home and I called her up. And she said, funny you should ask. In a couple of weeks, we're going to have a conference here about women in academia and
mm-hmm.
women's liberation and stuff like that. Would you like to come? And I said, yes, I'd like to come. But I got to find out if I can get some money to do it.
Uh-huh.
So I went to Mr. Runkle. And I told him what I'd learned and that I wanted to go out to Connecticut. And he said, sure, I'll pay for you. So out I went. And lots of the people that you hear about today as having been the founding mothers
uh-huh.
of women's studies were there.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all so wonderful. It was so different from an American Philosophical Association,
mm-hmm.
Any of the, what they in those days would call a male-identified conference, or a male-identified mm-hmm. program. They were so, I think it was Tobias, came in and she said, good morning. This was at Wesleyan. Before we start, does anyone have a tampon size regular? God damn, I'm home. This is wonderful.
Yes.
It was so friendly
uh-huh.
and informal, and it was extraordinary. It was, I think we did 3 days. I can't remember exactly. I think it was 3 days. And at that conference, we named it Women's Studies.
Oh, I
what
see.
Shall we call this new study that we're doing? And some people
uh-huh.
suggested feminist studies, and there were those who said, you know, that's really going to knock these guys on their can if you say feminist, they're so afraid of that word.
Uh-huh.
Why don't we call it, first it was women's research, and then it was this and that, and we
uh-huh.
had a bunch of different, and women's studies came out of that conference. And
so you sort of paved the way for Camille Paglia there.
Yeah. So, but we don't use that word.
Okay.
So Sheila Tobias, I think, was the leading proponent. And the woman who set up the feminist press, what was her first name? How was her second name? She founded the feminist press.
Mm-hmm.
Kirsten Amundsen, I think, was another woman.
Hmm.
Lots of the people that wrote the first important book.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometime during those 3 days, they were handing each other articles that they had written or articles that they uh-huh. had seen. Here I wrote this, here I wrote that, here I got this from a woman in a march in Washington. And so I came home with a stack of articles,
mm-hmm.
which was the beginning of my reading, because you couldn't find it in traditional
mm-hmm.
texts, and also names, people, and, you know, the mm-hmm. titles. There were some at in Springfield and well, they were all over the place, and I lit up like a Christmas tree when I read them, and it was just like, oh my God, oh my God, oh, that's right, I didn't think of that, you know, just, it was wonderful. But I think it was the beginning of my thinking that I could be a philosopher
mm-hmm.
and an academician and do some serious work
mm-hmm.
in women-related issues.
Well, was this the origin then of your first book?
It was.
Uh-huh.
Because what I did, I think the following year, I introduced a course called Issues in Feminism.
Mm-hmm. This would be 1972 that you...
I got here mm-hmm. in 71. This would be either 72 or 73. I'm not
okay.
sure which.
Okay.
But I introduced that course, and I had to go before the committee, I don't know how many times. They just kept saying
the departmental committee?
Interdepartmental.
Okay.
It was the school in
school committee.
That day we had, it was called the School of Humanities.
Mm-hmm.
And it was made up of English, philosophy, and I think foreign languages.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept introducing this, and they kept saying, no, 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 this is not sensible academic work. But finally, they said, on an experimental basis, they would let me give it a shot for a year. And students were just crazy to sign
yes.
up. There were some men, I'm guessing out of 40 students in a class, I think in the beginning is what I had, 40, 45, I can't remember exactly. But there may be three or four men who,
mm-hmm.
who wanted, but mostly it was women, and they were just crazed to sign up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was wonderful, the courses were absolutely wonderful.
Uh-huh.
And there were no textbooks. There were no books. I mean, what could you assign? So I used these articles.
Uh-huh.
And then people would send me, you know, as I
yes.
would write to other people and talk to them, they would send me articles. And so it started to be a stack about that big.
Mm-hmm.
And then the students would come, and I mimeographed these. I mean, we didn't have
yeah,
computers, so we mimeographed them. And I used to have stacks when I walked into class,
mm-hmm.
like that big. And then students would come up and say, you know what? My mother needs this stuff. Could you give me an extra stack for my mother? Could you give me an extra stack for my sister? And I'd say, sure, have a stack. So that stack of articles started to be refined.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I dumped some, I put others in. And one afternoon, I was sitting in my office, minding my own business, when a man knocked on my door to sell me philosophy books. And he said, "By the way, do you have any projects you're interested in doing?" And I don't know where it came from, but I said yes, because I surely did not at that time have any project like this on my mind. I said, "Yeah, you know, see that stack of articles over there? That ought to be made into a book." And then we talked a couple of minutes, and he left. And lo and behold, I got a phone call from a lady in Houghton Mifflin. Said, "I understand you're interested in doing a book." And I said, "Well, I have this stack of articles."
Yep.
And she said, "Why don't you write me a prospectus?" "Sure," says I, like I know what the hell a prospectus is. Which I didn't. I have no idea. And I wrote this thing and sent it to her. And she called and said, "You don't know what a prospectus is, do you?" And I said, "Truly, no, I don't." She said, "Well, I'll send you one so you can see. And you write me one and we'll see where we go."
That was nice.
It was. She was lovely. And so we signed a contract. And what I did was I essentially wrote 10 lectures in different topics and took the articles that were attached to that topic from my class and wrote. And interestingly, I was almost half finished. It was 2 years that I'd been working on it, or more, I remember. And they never called me back. I'd, you know, leave messages and say, "You know, I have some material for you to see." And finally I started getting suspicious. I'd phone, nobody would answer the phone. I'd leave messages, nobody would call me back. And I thought, something bad is going on here.
Did you have a contract?
Yeah.
Okay, well.
I did.
Uh-huh.
But I was so green, Ellen. I mean, I didn't know nothing about nothing. And I don't remember who it was, but I was sitting in Schwartz's. Do you remember when Schwartz's had a breakfast thing?
Yes.
I was sitting next to some faculty member, and I was telling him how I couldn't get hold of these people, and he said, "Sheila, editors pester you about getting done. If they won't answer your phone call, something terrible's going on." And I said, "What do I do?" And he said, "I know, you better get them on the phone." And they told me that the woman who was my editor had resigned. She wasn't working with them anymore. Phoned you at 9 o'clock. And it turned out to be the president of Houghton Mifflin. And he said, "But, you know, don't just agree to any old thing." And I'm thinking, "What? Well, it turned out that they had done this to a number of authors who were in their, quote, women's literature division. And so he filed a class action suit, which scared the living daylights out of the legal beagles. So this guy called me up and said, essentially, "What do you want?" And I said, "Oh, we can give you this money, we can give you this time." And I said, "Look, I want two things. I want you to publish this book. And I want you," I said, "you know, I have waited and waited to hear from you, and now my sabbatical is over, and I have to go back to work, so I want you to give me a sabbatical for two semesters, pay my salary, and publish my book." And he said, "Okay." And so that's how that book came out.
And now it's been in 3 or 4 editions.
Five. After
and they must have made enormous amounts of money on it.
You know what? It actually, when it really made money, that book
was the only textbook in women's studies mm-hmm. for several years. And I think it was, I had called them after about 5 years and said, you know, maybe we ought to update it. There's a lot of, you know, no, they didn't want to do that. Okay. So I think it was like 10 years after it came out, I got a call from Frank something, who was an editor at Mayfield Publishing. Mm-hmm. And he said, that's a nice little book. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about Mayfield taking it over and doing, we can do a second edition? And I said, well, it belongs to Houghton Mifflin. And he said, that's no problem, we'll buy it. Which I didn't know they did. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this guy is, you know, who is this?
Yes.
I'll come out and see you if you like, or, you know, you can come out here and we'll pay your way. It was in California. You can meet the people here. And they said, okay. And I did. And they were wonderful. So they bought the book from Houghton Mifflin, and it was they who did mm-hmm. all the success of up through the fifth edition, and then Mayfield was purchased by McGraw-Hill. Mm-hmm. Couple of years ago, and I have not done another. I do not like working for that huge company. Uh-huh. I mean, you could never get through with questions, and I was ready to retire.
Uh-huh.
And the other thing is that women's studies literature and women's studies itself has changed dramatically. What some people talk about is it has gone almost entirely to, quote, identity politics. Mm-hmm. You know, what it's like growing up Native American girl.
Uh-huh.
What it's like... Hey, baby!
Hi, girls! Girls!
Hi. How are you? And bears?
Huh?
Gladels and Boys, you know Ellen?
Yes, it's been a long time. Hi, Calvin. I haven't seen you in many months.
I haven't seen you for a long time.
Many months. Oh,
yeah.
Are you getting... Is she a good interviewer?
Yes.
Great storytelling. It's become identity politics.
More than anything else.
Uh-huh.
They, you know how the women's movement has really morphed into something else today?
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't... It's not as reflective as it was mm-hmm. in the 60s and 70s, and it in some ways reflects the culture as it... You know, what people care uh-huh. about today, you know, what kind of job, how much money can you make.
Mm-hmm.
The issues that really motivated me and women like myself in the 70s, how to improve the world,
Yes.
You know, let's make things better, mm-hmm. you know, all that stuff. They don't talk about that much.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that happened that really made me give up writing the book, every time I did a new edition, the editors would say, you know, you need to simplify your language. And I'd say, in what way?
Uh-huh.
Well, they can't read this. And I said, what do you mean they can't read it? Well, your vocabulary, you need to sort of stick with two-syllable words,
uh-huh.
simplify it. So I would do that until finally the last time when for my last edition, I wrote this whole section on the nature of theory and what theory meant
mm-hmm.
and why it was important to feminist analysis
yes.
and, you know, how it fit into the sciences. And I thought it was great. I really did.
Yeah.
I thought it was the best edition I'd done. And they said, you need to drop this.
Mm.
They'll never... First place, they can't read it. And in the second place, they don't have any interest in it.
Uh-huh.
And I said, I won't drop it. It's important. Each edition, the editor would send out a questionnaire mm-hmm. to, say, half a dozen schools that were using the text, and they would ask them to comment both on my text and on the articles, what they liked, what they didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd always get
three or four of them that said, you know, this book, we have a very bright student body, and you know, this book has the substance they need, and we want that. And there were a like number that said, you know, well, we leave out the Sheila's text because they can't read that. Mm-hmm. And we just read the articles, a good selection of articles. But as time went on, there was more of, the students can't read this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't hard. It was written for undergraduates.
Mm-hmm.
And I found myself resisting
mm-hmm.
what they were asking me to do. And finally, I just put my little flat foot on the ground and said, no. So when they got sold to McGraw-Hill, I did not pursue another edition.
And what year was that? What, 95 or?
Well, let me see when the last edition came out.
It's an interdisciplinary
it
book.
It is interdisciplinary.
Uh-huh.
And the fundamental direction of the book
mm-hmm.
is theoretical.
Mm-hmm.
And it is in the area that one would call radical feminism.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, you know, what do I mean by that? There was a quotation, and again, I have to remember what book it was. One of the very earliest feminist books, which said, what we mean by radical, if you look at the base of the word radical, it means root.
Mm-hmm.
We go to the root of the issue. And if there was a word bigger than revolution, we would use it. So it's theoretical, and it goes all the way to the root of the issue.
Mm-hmm.
American feminism has moved away from that approach.
Uh-huh.
British feminism and Australian feminism is still there.
Mm-hmm.
French feminism is in an entirely different arena.
Mm-hmm.
And most people in this country don't want to write from that perspective anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So it is not history in the sense that it's not descriptive, although its history is included.
Mm-hmm.
It's not purely political, because although that's included, the point of the book is to understand.
Mm-hmm.
So it is essentially philosophical.
Mm-hmm.
Analytical. And revolutionary.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now, is that where the women's movement is today? I don't think so. I don't think it's revolutionary. I don't even know if the women's movement exists as a women's movement.
Anymore.
I mean, the EEOC is gone.
Mm-hmm.
Right? People have overturned affirmative action
mm-hmm.
and nobody screams about it. Nobody even knows it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
We're about to lose abortion rights and there are no women in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
I have a great interest in feminist religion and feminist spirituality.
Yes, that was your last book, wasn't it?
That was my last book, but it is
your last one that you wrote,
yeah.
Written so far.
Yeah. That was Take Back the Light. And that is as radical,
mm-hmm.
although there were many in women's studies who figured that I'd lost it altogether. Now, Sheila's gone over the, you know, she's gone over the other side. Um, I don't hear, I don't even see that anymore. I mean, yes, there are women who want to be ministers and they're fighting the fight and, you know, but they're not fighting them from the perspective of this will improve your religious understanding. They are fighting it from the perspective of I have as much of a right to do this work as you do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the second idea is based on the first idea.
Mm-hmm.
Religious or spiritual analysis entirely from a male perspective ain't even half the story.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't see much of that in the literature anymore. So people may not want to work on this kind of book.
Mm-hmm.
What they, you know, if your friends have any interest, what they need to do is pick up the textbook, look at it, see if it's anything.
Well, I'm sure they're familiar with it. I think it's still used at SIU.
Is it? Is
yeah,
it
I think it is. I think it is. I'm not sure.
I know one or two people, I know for sure, don't use it.
Mm.
But I don't know if anybody still does use it.
Uh-huh.
I have nothing to do with the Women's Studies program at SIU.
Okay.
And I don't even know who's in it.
Uh-huh. Well, I'll have to ask. I bet Annie's used it. Not.
Hey, you know, I'd love to have somebody do a revision.
But anyway,
but
that's, you know.
Yeah, but I thought about that for a while. I thought of contacting some of my friends in Australia.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Well, I mean, I have a lot of publishing of women's studies, both
mm-hmm.
here and they did some wonderful stuff, and they moved to Australia.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they are a group of rayon, they really are, and I would trust them to do the work.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not worried about working, you know, with Australia or any other country. I just don't know if I want to go back to working. My memory doesn't work the way it used
uh-huh.
to. I'm not as facile writing, and I'm blind. So I just don't know.
Uh-huh.
I love being unemployed.
I think I really do too. I think this, I see this project, the history of the university, is.
Uh-huh. You know, people always ask me what I'm doing, and I don't know how to answer this. Do you have a project? I always hear from people.
I know, you hear that from people.
Yeah, so what are you working on now?
My garden.
And I always say nothing.
Yeah.
The truth is, the project is me.
Uh-huh.
And am I traveling? If I were to say it to anybody else, the answer is yes. Interiorly,
mm-hmm.
I'm traveling inside and out. Now that sounds pretty bizarre, but I am very interested in consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And spirituality and inner development.
You still go, are you still a Quaker?
Yes.
Yes, just so you know, Tamaris.
Yes.
Yeah, yes.
Yes. Right. Yes. Oh, they are lovely.
Yeah.
They are lovely people.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I do.
So are you writing something?
I do write.
Uh-huh.
But I don't write for publication.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even write for anybody to see it.
Uh-huh.
I have a mentor at the meeting. He's quite wonderful, and he's been teaching me a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I write for him, and I write for me. But I can't imagine publishing this. It's so personal.
Mm-hmm.
And people.
There's a lot of interest in that now, though.
You know.
In autobiography. Annie Valk and Shirley Portwood and I read women's autobiographies.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
All the time when we meet about once
really?
A while.
Uh-huh. And what do you glean from that?
don't know. I guess we're looking at other people. I don't know. Not looking at ourselves.
Well,
and learning about where they're always somehow connected with American history.
No. Of course, you're a historian.
We're all American historians.
Sure,
so.
Sure.
Lots of them were women who have been in the civil rights movement. And
Well, that makes sense for you to be reading that.
Yeah, and I have been reading autobiographies of people who have been studying Zen and studying Buddhism. And I'm very interested in that. But I'm not a dabbler.
Sounds
fun. It's, you know, when I try to explain to people sometimes where I am, what I'm doing.
No, it sounds wonderful to me.
Oh, but people look at me and kind of scratch their head and think, another one of those dabblers.
Oh.
And I'm not a dabbler.
Anyway, what's a dabbler? I mean, what is wrong?
Playing.
Because you don't come out of it pretending to be a Buddhist. That to me, that's a dabbler.
Yeah,
that's a true dabbler. Someone who reads.
Well, you got to. But people do look at me when I say that. You know, I was at a university function last year. I don't remember which one. Whether it was a retirement thing or something like that, and. One of the administrators, who shall remain nameless at this point, said, "Oh, Sheila, what are you doing with yourself?" And I said, "Nothing." I don't know what to say. "What do you mean, nothing?" And I said, "Well, I mean nothing that anybody would be interested in." And he said, "I can't believe that. You were always so energetic." And I said, "I'm still energetic, but I like being retired." "Well, are you traveling?" "Not exactly."
Yeah.
I'm not going to say, "Yeah, I'm traveling inside. I want to be conscious of it." Right? And I said, no, actually, I don't. I always thought that I'd want to when I finished, but I really don't have any interest in it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that I know sounds
I think that's in a way a form of dabbling. The way it's usually done.
I'll take one of those trips where you see 15 different countries in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Not my thing.
Uh-huh.
When I did go to England, I was odd man out. I found places that I thought were extraordinary. I wanted to plunk down there and stay there for 3 weeks and sit and look at it. But that is not what the rest of the company wanted to do. So I love where I am. Mike and I have a boat in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
And every other week we go there.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not a boater as in let's go to another harbor. I love to sit on the back of the boat and watch the wildlife. It's like your garden.
Mm-hmm.
Only I don't have a garden, but I love the wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the environment. I love to just sit and look at the water and the trees and the sky. And it puts me in a different place emotionally. And I'm never tired.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what I spend a lot of time doing, and that leads me to an understanding and an experience that are like sugar candy. I can't get enough of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I spend much of my time doing that kind of thing. I just love it. I like to read a lot for the same reasons. I spend a lot of time with the cat.
Mm-hmm.
For the same reason. And that's what I do. But, you know, to say to university people, "Well, I'm spending a lot of time with my cat," just doesn't go down right. You know what I'm saying?
I know what you mean.
So, and I don't feel apologetic about it, but when I try to communicate that to people and I get that funny look, I become apologetic.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't communicate it. Not that I'm trying to keep it a secret, but I don't know how to put it into words. So I don't. I would love to work with students in a non... I used to think that when I retired, I could be the old fart of the department and spend time with students, help them with their philosophy if they wanted. I've got 42 years training in logic, and they hate it, and I can teach it. They have no interest in that. And so then I could share some of what I have evolved into. But I don't think that's very likely going to happen.
No.
They don't want it. I don't want to teach again, as in term papers and grades and, you know, I am so past that. But to teach in terms of sharing, understanding with students, this I would love. But that is not going to happen. And how are you going to offer that?
Well, you probably do it in the meeting. My sister Annie's a Quaker, and
gone
to the meeting with her in San Francisco, and people really say wonderful things in the meeting.
Yeah.
I'm sure you're one of those sometimes.
Sometimes. The less
a really
I'm there, the
form
less
of
I
teaching.
Say. It is. I love going to meetings, and I've been doing it 35 years, 37 or something like this. I think I started in 73. But the longer I'm there, the more I learn to keep my position. I mean,
well, yes,
not to speak until you have something truly valuable to share. And so, you know, the longer I'm there, the more
reticent. No.
Oh, yeah, but
cautious.
Now, understand
maybe
my...
Maybe thoughtful.
Is this truly an insight of the eternal for the value of the people who are here? And I don't mean God in the simplest sense. Nothing like that, but my insights, are they mine, or are they truly of the universe? Are they of value? I don't want to talk for me. I should talk for them. I mean, that really is what meeting is about. So more and more, I listen and I'm quiet. When I was a youngster, I had a big mouth. Little mouth. It's like, you know, I don't know how to garden. I envy that.
I go out there and 8 o'clock in the morning, and I'll come in, it's 4 in the afternoon.
Really?
I've been out there all day, you know.
Really?
And a lot of times I am just looking at, just quietly looking at the insects and, you know, watching birds and...
Yes, I understand.
Or just looking at the ground
and
thinking about it.
Deeply moving.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
I really love it.
Yeah. Deeply spiritual. That's what I do on the back.
Yes, that's when you say you're like looking at the clouds.
You just sit there and
that's what
be
I,
with it.
Yeah.
Do you have the time to do that now?
Actually, it's taken with this terrible drought. It's taken a lot.
Oh, God, yeah.
And I don't know. No, I don't have as much time as I want to have out there.
Is there any way to manage that? This is the main thing.
Oh, this
your
is
way?
The main thing in my way. It's really definitely the main thing. And I do manage it. I spent all weekend out there.
Oh, how wonderful. Even though you were, you must have frozen.
Even though I had this deadline coming up on this.
Oh, my
but,
God.
No, it's. I think what you're saying is when you reach a certain age, you begin to see what's really important. And then it's terribly hard to get back to.
Bullshit.
Yes. Once you've turned the corner, it's very hard to go back.
You don't go back.
No.
You can't go back.
Can't. But it's soon going to be over.
What would happen if you just stopped?
Well, it would be pretty bad because, I don't know, I found out in doing this, Sharon Haas was the one who asked me, and I have to say that I did say, you know, you should ask Steve Kerber to do it. I know that he...
And he was the archivist?
He's the archivist who's been, oh, he's been so horrible. And I'm a person who can't stand that, you know. And she said, no, you know, whatever, I don't remember what she said. And I should have said, no, I'm not doing it, you have to ask him, but I didn't. That was my mistake.
Could you now?
And now, well, now it's just she's had a whole lot of things fall down in her. You know, she's. Did you know what's happened to her? It's Kim Kern. This is how this new guy works, and I think he's a change for the university. Although maybe you know things have always been this bad, but I don't think they have. Kimberly Kern. One day, she just was shoved down into this little office. It's like a little closet, and she's told that. The guy is coming from, well, now Sharon Haas is in a little office in the Pet building.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
And I think she's still looking for a presidency, but I don't know if she's going to find one or not. And I know, I was never one of her greatest fans. No, we shouldn't be recording.
I don't feel that way. I don't know how. But somehow I am led to go inside, and maybe the answers are there.
Uh-huh.
That, you know...
Are you thinking you'll have an insight? And
you know, the great sages all talk about withdrawal for a time.
Yes.
You know, his Buddha sitting under his tree.
Yeah.
And then taking what he learns out. I am still sitting under the tree. I don't know enough. I don't know anything. And I find that not knowing okay. I don't know where I'm being led. I don't know what I feel when I'm with it that there is some sense of meaning that I can just dimly see and almost grasp. And I have this strong sense that I need to stay with it, to be there. To look at the lake, to watch the creatures, they're telling me stuff.
Well, when you were teaching, you did have such a powerful influence on people. You know, they formed this organization.
They're all
continuing to be influenced by you.
Well, I think
they are.
There were people like that, and I loved doing that.
Uh-huh.
I did. And even in my lectures, when I went out into, you know, I did lecturing for businesses and universities.
Yes.
And I always snuck it in under cover of other things, but I talked about the importance of understanding and personal growth and spiritual. And I mean that in a non-religious sense. The importance of almost a platonic sense of becoming.
Huh.
And people responded to that because I think they started for, I don't think it's available.
and the old religions are too goofy to appeal to lots. Pretty goofy, come on, you know. And they know it. You know, when people harangue them about.
But it seems like many, many people are attracted to that too.
Yes.
I'm just thinking, but I think of you as someone who always created islands of people who are people who are going to be all right.
They were
in their heads. They're going to be all right.
Yeah, they are. I think all I did was to say to those people, it's all right. It's all right. You know, you follow it. And I still feel that way. You know me? Some of the sages say, you know, if you find that center in yourself, it moves outward to other people. And I have... In these later years, when I've said, how can I serve? It was different from when I was younger, being on marches were how I served. I don't think that went... I mean, you know, clearly, here was the women's movement, and I really felt it was a service. But it's gone. Where the hell did it go? Now, there have been changes. I'm not sure all of them are what we had in mind. But now... I feel that I serve in very small ways with individual people. And by just finding my own center, maybe that's the way to serve. So, I can't tell that to people at the university and say, what the hell are you doing?
What are you doing?
You know, so I say nothing. I can't tell them that. They would think I had gone completely daft. Well, don't you think they would?
Yes, I think most people would, probably.
Yeah, I think they would. And you can see it in their eyes. It's like, oh, really?
Yeah.
Very nice. I think I have to go talk to somebody. I know, so I don't do it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think many of us who went into teaching, went to the university, had these very altruistic goals.
Well, you were very involved in the union.
Yes.
And so tell me about that.
Well, that again was service.
That's
funny. I think people thought it was very different when I did it. You know, I was being a pain in the ass. And then I said, well, I had always believed in unions. My father was a strong union man. And being a construction worker and a truck driver and so on, he had always said that the safety of the common man, the worker, was in being with other workers.
Sure.
In a union. And I believed that. So I had always felt that union was a good thing. And I don't remember the year the NEA showed up on campus.
I think it was about 1974.
Was it that early?
It was before John Rendleman died. Because John Rendleman, they always expected to deal with the unions. They didn't go out and hire a big union busting firm like later administrations did.
You know,
they had a little exchange about what are we going to do about this, and basically they said, well, you know,
we'll work
with them. Yeah, that's how they handled things.
That was not when I came in. I don't remember that time. I was here in 1974.
It seems like
Kleenex.
No, I'm okay. All right, yeah.
I think I can't remember, but I think my involvement was later, maybe in the 80s.
Maybe, yeah. There were elections in There was an election in 89. There was an election in 88 for where people overwhelmingly voted to have an agent, but you were split between AFT and IEA.
Well,
and then no agent, but the majority voted for, clearly, a large majority voted for some agent. And then they had an election where everybody tried to get together, the AAUP and the AFT and the IEA, but then it broke down.
I don't remember that one later. When I was working with the union, there were two unions. Well, of course, AAUP had been here.
Uh-huh.
And NEA showed up. Or IEA, the Illinois Education Association.
Yeah.
And I did not want to get involved.
Uh-huh.
And I don't remember what or why, but...
Well, it was known as an organization mainly of I think, high school teachers. And
I didn't want to get involved in union, uh-huh, period.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't want to get involved in politics. I just wanted to read my books and write my articles. And there was, I can't remember the names, boy, I'll tell you what, I bet I never forget them. But there was this young man who was one of the agents for the IEA, and he came...
David Bitoff? No.
He was one of them, but there was the other one whose name was, we used to call him The Force.
Oh, okay.
He was Mr. Energy.
Uh-huh.
And I can't believe I think he settled in Edwards. He and his wife and two children. Maybe I could find that.
Uh-huh.
God knows.
Well, I could look and see. There's David Bitoff is the one I have known.
Uh-huh.
So I don't
he
remember the other guy.
Guy.
Yeah, I
he
know.
He worked with this guy,
uh-huh,
and it was before they built that building over here on Santa Cruz Road.
Yes.
You know? Okay.
I know where it is.
It was before that building.
Okay.
And so this, maybe he was with David at the time, but he stopped in at my office. And I think he was just going from office to office.
Uh-huh.
And he stopped in at my office and said, can I talk to you? And I said, you're the union guy, aren't you? And he said, yeah. And I said, sure. So, you know, just to be nice. And he sat down in my office and started telling me about what unions were and stuff. And I said, you don't need to say any more to me. I am pro-union. I have always been pro-union.
Yeah.
Oh, says he. I think his eyes lit up, as in he caught one. And I said, I don't think this place is ready for a union. Well, you know, you got to do this and that to get it ready and so on. And he said, I'd love to talk to you about what our union could do here. What are your main concerns? And I said, well, you know, I'm concerned about my salary and other issues like that. I said, but that's not my main concern. My main concern at the time was the diminution of faculty rights and the,
uh-huh,
the fact that university academic decisions were being taken over by non-faculty people, and I thought that was wrong. And I said, classroom size, and I don't know, how can you teach when you've got 50 kids in a room? And he said, that's just what we're concerned about. Can't we get together and talk about? And I said, I don't think I want it. Oh, please, just give us a chance to talk to some people. And I said, there are not a lot of people who really care about this.
Uh-huh.
But he said, but if you could just gather a half a dozen, I said, well, I probably could get a half a dozen. Oh, good, let's meet at your house, said he, and I went there. Before I knew what I was doing, I said, yes. And so we gathered in my living room. Dave Bitoff might have been there,
uh-huh,
but this other guy who was...
Yeah, I could find him. John Juki gave me a whole archive of stuff.
I recognize his name. If I saw it, I could recognize his name. And
seems like it's Metzger or Metzler.
There were a whole bunch of guys involved. And so this young man, and I believe Fithoff might have been with him, and maybe a half a dozen people from SRU, and I do not remember who they were, and myself, met in my living room. We sat in a circle. I don't remember much of the conversation, except we talked about the things we were concerned about. And I remember specifically what this guy said, which turned my crank, was that we believe in academic standards. We do not want to take the low road. We want to take the high road. We are committed to values. We are committed to good teaching. I mean, you know, he just turned my crank. Everything that I cared about. And he was distinguishing himself from AFT, and he said, they're more down and dirty, but something that, you know, they're more confrontive, they're more aggressive, we want to reason with people. And it turned out that way. And I said, well, that attracts me. Because there was this contention between obviously what they were doing was trying to win who's going to be the leader. And I was attracted to this guy, who was very bright. He understood academia. I had met the AFT people, and I agreed with his assessment that they were a tougher bunch.
Yeah.
Now, there were a lot of my friends who said, that's what we need. You know, we need somebody. I mean, the administration.
John Farley was an AFT.
Farley was.
Right.
And I think Rosanda was AFT.
Yes, Rosanda was.
And I had a lot of respect for Rosanda. I thought, the fact that she was AFT really made me stop and pause. But the more these guys talk, the better I like them. And so when I got into it, it was never my intention to do a contest, you know, this kind of stuff, but that's what happened. And it started getting nasty, and you know, when it got nasty, then I got more confronted. I didn't want to do that. And I remember finally, it came up for a vote. This is after 3 years. And I kept saying, look, I don't want to be the head of this thing, you know. The more I said, the more I found myself. I kept using my name as head of the NEA, and I thought, oh no, that is not the idea. But and I've forgotten the name. Oh, one of the guys who worked with us has since become the provost.
Dave Sill
from sociology, right?
Oh, yeah, he was from speech communication.
Oh, speech communication.
But in his interview, he told me that he sort of, after a while, he really had second thoughts about it. And he's the one who supported Bud Hirsch to be president of the Faculty Senate. I guess now he's a high administrator who's trying to do something about his past there. But
yeah, well, he might have.
I saw things by him. But, I mean, he published letters to the editor.
Yeah, he was very active. Yeah. And I really was very surprised to see him shift views. But, you know, sometimes you do change your mind about things. I don't think that's an impossibility. And I had a lot of respect for Dave when he was working with us. And especially you know, a lot of the people were, hi, Boise. And this is Sam, who owns the house.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Hi, baby.
We had a black cat named Esther. She lived to be 23.
Really?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Oh, I hope you do that.